welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Delling Pod. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but I am. I've got a real person on this week, Sharon Smith. Sharon, you're a real person, aren't you?
I am a real person, definitely.
I mean, you don't do podcasts and vid. You know, you're not on the podcast vidcast circuit, no. Which I think is really good, because actually, I think we need. You know, what's going on right now? I'm quite interested in hearing the stories of people who are fighting back against this lunacy. So first of all, tell me about yourself. Tell me about your you were a Tory councillor, is that right?
Yeah, I was a Tory candidate, Tory party candidate, fully paid member.
A candidate, right.
For local council.
Right.
And, you know, I went to all the talks with Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg and dinner party speeches and, you know, before the election. And, you know, I was out there campaigning and I was a 100% dedicated Tory. And I listened to Boris and Jacob tell us about how they were going to get rid of the nanny state.
Is that what they said to you?
Yeah. And both of them did speeches. You know, I've heard speeches from both of them. Where, you know, and it was just before the general election. And you know, I was fully taken in by all of that, completely taken in about how they were libertarians. And then obviously on the 23rd of March, I listened to that speech from Boris, and that was that for me. That was it. I was out.
You knew then, right at the beginning, that it was...
straight away.
That's interesting, because a lot of people were at the time thinking, well, oh, I don't know about this virus. Maybe we will have to shut the country for a bit, because after all, look at what's happening in Italy. I think Italy was a you know, the sort of driver, I think, for a lot of the panic in England.
Yeah.
And if you remember, I remember going to... I went through a phase where I thought it was a worrying thing, because I'd been following this, because I spend a lot of time, too much time actually, as you know, because you follow my podcast, lurking on the internet, spending way too much time on Twitter. And I was getting all this interesting stuff coming out of China, first of all, about how people were being immured in their homes, you know, being welded into their homes, and hospitals were being built, and there was a recording of this conversation with somebody was trying to get a sick relative into the hospital, and the translation said that, you know, all the doctors are either dead or ill. And I thought, well, this stuff being sneaked out of China, it must be indicative of a, this is the big one. So, and then not long before that announcement, when Boris said, you know, I'm locking you all down, I went to a northern Italian restaurant near Westminster, where a lot of MPs go. And I remember talking to the Italian waitress at this place, and I said, you know, is it serious? Do you think we should be? She said, oh, yeah, it's really bad. You know, I'm very surprised that you haven't locked down already. So I was kind of... I wouldn't say I was pro-lockdown, but I was thinking, well, they must know what they were doing. So tell me what you knew at the time, even then, that showed you it was rubbish.
So at that time, I've got two friends who are eminent scientists. To be fair, they are, you know, they're very high up in their field. I won't name them, but they, you know, they're very high up in their field. And they'd assured me that they just thought it was basically nonsense. The China thing was, you know, they in their opinion, it was overinflated. And then everybody knows that Italy, you know, it's a very strange place. They've got an aging population and a very strange way of living. So, yeah, they assured me it was, you know, nothing really to worry about. And I fully believe that, and I still believe that. So that's that. But the whole Boris thing, he was going to go for herd immunity, which is what my friends were saying that, you know, should have happened. And, you know, from a man that said he was a libertarian to do that just seemed completely crazy. So yeah, that was me. I was out then. I was completely, count me out of everything to do with the Tories. I'm finished. And from being a lifelong Tory, that's quite shocking. But I just knew that was wrong.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think a lot of us do feel like we've been sold the most massive pup by the Conservatives. But it interests me that it wasn't just my kind of, you know, how we all project our particular politics onto politicians. So those who are Thatcherites, like I suppose myself, more or less, we cherry pick every statement from people like the Mog father. Remember those days where he was the great white hope of the party?
I've got photos of me with him thinking that he was just the best thing ever. And now,
Do you know what? I feel like a woman must do where she really fancies this man and she's gone out on a date with him and he's turned out to be a rapist or something like that. You know, I feel like that. I feel like that about Jacob and Boris. You know, they seem like gentlemen and then look what they've done. They're absolute. I went out for lunch. Jacob took me to his one of his clubs and my son. And we had the most fantastic time. And Jacob was playing the Jacob role, you know, urbane, witty, very much 18th century mode. He sort of quietly reassuring one that the future was safe in the hands of the Conservative Party, and that he was representative of a kind of a faction within the party which would ultimately be in charge of its policy. And so what it's interesting that both Jacob and Boris were making these I'm a libertarian speeches. And where you're in Wales, aren't you?
I'm Wales. So Jacob came up to Wales and had there's been two times when he's come and done after done speeches.
Yeah.
And then Boris came up just before the election. He came up to near Wrexham. And obviously certain Tory party members were invited to, you know, him to hear him say a speech. And there was that. But, you know, even if there was a deadly virus, I don't think it was their place. It was their place to advise us and tell us what they knew, but it wasn't their place to control us.
Yeah,
that's my view. Anyway.
Yes. No, well, we'll move on to the virus thing in a moment. I just want you to just like establish what's going on here, because Wrexham is that are there any conservatives, many conservatives in that part of the country?
Our MP sadly but I can campaign for him, but you know, I wouldn't have anything to do with him ever again. But our local MP is a Tory as well.
Who's that?
And the Welsh government, Robin Miller, his name is.
I think I went on Any Questions once in Wrexham, or near Wrexham. So yeah. Because one sometimes thinks of Wales as being a kind of complete socialist state, doesn't one? You know, with the Welsh Assembly and stuff.
North Wales as such, but the Welsh Assembly, so Janet Finch Saunders is our Welsh Assembly member.
Yeah.
But the Welsh Assembly elections are coming up on the 6th of May, which is one of the things that I wanted to talk about, because I'm now a candidate, which is very awkward, to be fair, because of the party that I'm actually representing.
No, I want to give you...
Completely rigged again.
Yeah, I want to give your candidacy a massive plug on this podcast. But before we do that, I just want to put the Conservatives to bed, because it's quite... I find it quite interesting, for example, that... You know, what I was saying earlier was that there are those within the kind of tradition that sees Margaret Thatcher, Jacob Rees-Mogg, or what we thought he represented, as the way forward for Conservatives. And then there's the kind of the wet faction, the greenest government ever, the kind of the David Cameron heir to Blair tradition, which we saw continued with Theresa May, and which we hoped that Boris Johnson would break from. But it's interesting that the message they were putting out to you people, you know, the conservative base, we are libertarians. So they were speaking with forked tongue, weren't they?
And getting rid of the nanny state. I remember that on every single speech that I heard from Jacob and from Boris, every single time they were saying they were going to, when they got elected, in the December, then they were going to get rid of the nanny state and people would be more responsible for themselves and there would be less benefits, there would be less, you know, less intrusion from the government in our personal lives. I actually remember those words being said. It was obviously extraordinary.
And I imagine that you as conservatives lapped this up and you just thought whatever you'd paid for the dinner as well.
Oh, people are the best thing ever. But the interesting thing is that a couple of my friends, Adele and Aldine, they were big Tory members as well. They were exactly on the same page as me. So the 23rd of March, they rang me and said, you know, this is absolute nonsense, isn't it? And you know, we're completely in agreement. And that they're local, lifelong Tories as well. So
I think
maybe the fact they did us a favour, because when you saw Boris say that on the 23rd of March last year, it was completely obvious. That was not the normal Boris speaking.
That's interesting. So do you think that, I mean, there are the two possibilities here, aren't there? One mm-hmm. is that Jacob and Boris were playing you when they were never serious about being the party of smaller government. They always had this massive sort of build back better agenda going, running through the party like an evil message in a stick of rock, and they were just hiding it from the base in order to, you know, they were just using you like in the rapist analogy I used, or Boris. I hate calling him Boris because it makes him sound like a kind of our friend and he's not. Johnson was somehow captured at some point by the globalist elite and just went off piste. Which do you think is
I think he actually meant what he said at the time, but something happened and I'm not sure. And I'm also not sure about when he supposedly got ill, but maybe that's just a very strange conspiracy theory. I don't know. But he seems to be the only person I've ever heard of that went into intensive care quite fat and came out even fatter. And, you know, that seemed very strange as well.
I suppose you'd have to notice that detail because men just don't. And we don't, you know, when you've had your hair cut, we don't notice, do we? So we're not going to notice if somebody's put on weight or that is interesting.
But he didn't come out of intensive care looking like a man that's been in intensive care, though, to be fair. Maybe that's just me, but it didn't seem right.
As you know, I know a lot of these people. I mean, either I've met them in the course of my work or I've known them as personal friends. You know, they were at university with me or whatever. I mean, Boris was at university with me. So was Gove. So were a few others. I've got my doubts about whether this wasn't planned. I don't think, for example, when you realize that environmentalism, this whole eco-fascist agenda that Johnson is heavily pushing now is intimately bound up with the agenda of the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset. I think that they were planning this stuff even when they came to see you. I just think they wanted to win.
That just makes it worse, doesn't it?
Well, it does.
Either explanation is unacceptable anyway, isn't it? Like you say, there's only two explanations and either one makes them as despicable as the other. So
I know you've had a really hard time of it for your, you've taken a fairly principled stand against lockdowns. Where are you on masks? Do you wear a mask when you go to the
store? I've never worn a mask. No. But I've had a few experiences where a group of us went to Bangor, Tesco's, weirdly, and went mass shopping without masks in. And we'd arranged it on a little Facebook group. Yeah. And there was only a dozen of us. And it was actually just something to do when you're bored on a Saturday afternoon. So who knows how this happened, but there was a dozen of us turned up at a supermarket, and there was about 60 police waiting for us. And they shut the supermarket. I've got videos of the policeman saying that I wasn't allowed in, that I had to have an exemption badge on me to get in. It was just absolutely over the top. In fact, it was quite amusing, really. But, you know, you just can't believe that they would do that for 12 people that were just going to go shopping. We're just going to go shopping, and we'd have probably got a bit bored and gone away. And it just turned into a big, massive, big rigmarole. It was mentioned on the Welsh government speeches about how there was irresponsible people that went to Tesco shopping. And it was just ridiculous.
Well,
really,
that's,
to be fair,
that's extraordinary. I mean, isn't the sinister part of that? That, look, I mean, you're not a terrorist. You're not a prominent figure with respect. How on earth did they know that this was coming? Who was monitoring you? Because this was a private group.
A private Facebook group. No idea. Well, it's happened to me before. So that was last year. But early in May, I ended up on the front page of the newspapers. May 2020, and I was accused of going to the Hyde Park protest in May 2020. Anyway, there was all sorts of palaver about it, and journalists get in touch and a lot of rigmarole. And the police inspector phoned me because I have a protection order because I've had problems with hunt saboteurs in the past, some serious trouble with hunt saboteurs.
Well, they've tried to hurt you. Right.
Yes, it's quite sinister, that as well, but that comes before. And interestingly, I don't know whether that's another reason I was quite open to this, because I've always thought there was some very strange agenda. And I know when I've listened to your podcast, it sort of comes with the same climate change hoax thing.
Yeah.
A police inspector, the local police inspector got in touch with me. And said, you know, I understand you've had some nasty messages and death threats, you know, because you've ended up on the front page of the newspapers, you've been accused of going to an anti-lockdown protest. I said, well, you know, it is what it is, it's fine. And then at the end of the phone call, and he said he was going to send me a fine for going to the protest. And I said, I didn't go to the protest. And what proof have you got that I even went? And he just said, well, you know, I'm going to send you the fine. I suggest that you just pay it, because if you pay it within 2 weeks, it'll only be £30. And I said, well, I won't pay it if it's 30 pence, because it's completely nonsense. And it's just unlawful. And, you know, what's all this about? Like you said, I'm not a terrorist. What am I even being accused of anyway? Going to sit in a park in the open air? And when the fine came, I refused to pay it. I went to court. And this inspector actually had put in writing and signed it that I made a full confession, which was completely untrue. It went to magistrates court, and I got found guilty because the magistrates had obviously got preconceived ideas, and they said they had been instructed to treat me as severely as possible. So there's actually an appeal for that going through a week on Friday. And it's incredible. You wouldn't believe the amount of palaver. And, you know, it's quite sinister that the police would do this.
Well, I hope you can see my shocked face. I mean, I am genuinely, I am gobsmacked by what you're telling me. So clearly that conversation with the policeman when he rang you up, feigning sympathy, all he was trying to trap you into a confession.
He phoned me from his mobile phone.
Yeah.
He phoned me on my mobile phone. He was somebody that I was used to speaking to because of this protection order.
Yeah.
And I was used to him ringing me to make sure I was okay. So to me, it was just a normal conversation about, are you okay? Is everything all right? Because a lot of the threats had been made suspected made by the Hunt saboteurs. And there's quite some sinister things that have happened in my past with regards to them.
Yeah.
So I was just used to that. And at the end of the conversation, I just basically got a, we're going to send you a fine. I would just pay it, Sharon. It's only 30 quid. And I thought, well, why should I? And why am I being framed for this? What's this all about? So yeah, it's pretty sinister.
Well, also, when you say that the magistrate told you he'd been instructed to deal with this case severely, instructed by whom?
No idea.
I mean,
but I'm one of the first ones that have gone to court for this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't believe it has any legal standing, does it, this fine that was imposed on you?
Well, apparently it does, because now I've had to see a barrister because we're going to appeal in the Crown Court, and that's going to be a week on Friday. And the barrister says that it has got standing in law. But you know, he's saying, well, he said there's no proof. I didn't go. There's no proof that I went, and that the inspector was trying to frame me.
Yeah.
Which clearly he was, because he said that I made a confession, but he did say in the magistrate's court he agreed that I hadn't made a confession after all, even though they were his words. He said our conversation implied that I'd gone, which I don't understand how a conversation can imply that I went at all.
No.
So he
was fudging it, wasn't he? I've suddenly remembered. I think I read a story at Breitbart quite recently about the Polish guy and his family. Who went to a
Luke.
A beach, didn't he?
Yes, near me.
And his boy was having mental health issues and was desperate for a day out at his favorite beach. So for a bit of therapy, this boy was taken out with, mum and dad went to the beach, and there they were questioned in the car park while buying an ice cream. And the Polish guy ended up being arrested and taken and strip searched.
That's what the North Wales police are like. And that those officers will have worked for this police inspector, Inspector Kirkham.
So, certainly. I've noticed that Welsh police generally are very, very eager beavers when it comes to things like speeding and stuff like that. They want to harass the motorists. They want to, I'm sure they'd be useless if your house was burgled, but they're brilliant at stopping you buying ice cream and speeding.
Yeah, they have to justify their existence somehow. And luckily here in North Wales, we don't have a very high crime rate, so they have to be busy doing other things. But this is quite shocking that they treat the public like this.
You see, what you were saying about fox hunting, I think a lot of us are coming round to the view that we're putting together, the last year has enabled us to put together pieces of the jigsaw which previously made no, we didn't realize that it was all part of the same problem. This has been the year of only connect, and we've suddenly realized that all the bad stuff that's happening now has been planned over a period of years, if not decades, actually if not centuries. But for example, I think the war on fox hunting is a war on rural communities. It's a war on the bonds that unite rural communities. I mean, you think about how the fox hunt works. You think about all the people who are dependent on it, ranging from the kennels and the huntsmen and the farrier and the repairing of fences, the dead stock which goes to feed the hounds. Everything, it binds communities in a way I think the big government hates, because these communities are discrete communities rather than sort of subjects of big government. The people know one another, they get to know the land, they get to know that they're bound by danger and excitement and camaraderie. And of course, this is anathema to the same way that the family as a unit is anathema to these people. They want to break down the things that bind us, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I just never understood that until now, but I always knew that was wrong, you know, and that the whole hunt saboteurs, the fact that they've always been financed, always, you know, just confused me. The man that was creating a lot of trouble for me anyway, you know, obviously has quite a lot of money. He's not even vegan, and was quite vocal in the fact that he was paid a lot of money to come out and do quite nasty things to the hunts in the Northwest, not just North Wales, but also the Northwest of England. There's been a lot of trouble, and it's mainly through one man, although I do know he's visited the Cotswolds a couple of times and created a few problems there as well. But you know, there's obviously a lot of money being, you know, put that way, and I just can't imagine who would finance all of that. But
that's, you know, interesting. I think that it's the same. I think what we're realizing, I used to be very puzzled by why George Soros financed all these groups. I mean, you know, that man is a billionaire several times over, I think, and he's got oodles of money and he pours it into these mostly hard left groups, radical groups of one sort or another. And I was thinking, well, what's his motivation?
Why would he do that?
But actually, these people are playing a long game, and it's a form of, I suppose. Well, you could call it global Marxism, except it's almost worse than that. They're trying to bring about the destruction of our civilization, I think, in all its forms. All the bonds that different groups have formed over centuries, they want to break down and destroy. I think Tony Blair was really where the rot set in, because you remember he got given a large chunk of money by, is it called the International Fund for Animal Welfare, I think, mega donation, which was then used to bring in the Hunting Act, I think, and to have a go at hunting. And you thought, well, why does it matter so much? And only now is it starting to make sense.
Agreed. And the thing is, they clearly don't care very much about animals at all, you know. It's not to do with animals, you know. The things that have happened to me that have involved when I was on my horse, you know, and there's an incident where my horses could have been killed. And
What happened?
You know, so clearly,
what did they
do? The car of this gentleman accidentally skidded right into where my horse was at the side of the road with me on him. Luckily, my horse is more alert than me, and he jumped out of the way. But if he hadn't, then, you know, something awful would have happened. And it just seemed that apparently it was 2 hours away from where this man lives, and he was just accidentally on a day out. And that's interesting, because the police at that time, you know, they said, well, it would never go through court. Even though I had a protection order, he wasn't meant to approach me. He was 2 hours away from his house at 7 o'clock in the morning, and his car accidentally skidded on some gravel and almost killed me. And obviously there'd been things that have happened before that. And they said if it went to court, there was no proof that he wasn't just casually having a day out.
That's extraordinary. So the police, I think, were acting against your interests, and probably against the interests of truth, because I would have thought that any halfway decent prosecutor would have found merit in that case. Because, like, details like the fact he's the time of day.
Yeah. And the court, but until now, I always thought the police were on our side. I was always a big supporter of the police.
Most conservatives are, or were.
Yes, and up until now. So that's another thing, you know. I always thought the police were on our side, and I always thought, well, gosh, you know, the courts are going to, you know, let us down. And I was always told by the police that they didn't have enough resources, but suddenly, you know, 60 police can turn up for a dozen people going shopping in Tesco's.
That is,
it's just quite shocking.
Bizarre that they knew. They've obviously been monitoring your Facebook group, unless can Facebook's algorithms detect insurrection?
I don't know. Who knows? So you wouldn't think they'd be that interested, would you?
And so just tell, because a lot of people listen to these podcasts for solace that they're not alone. People need to know, because I think people have felt so isolated. And I think part of the tactic that is going on here, it's designed to isolate people, to break down their ability to resist apart from anything else, because it's when people converse. As a sidetrack here, I just started reading Jordan Peterson's new book, probably 12 More Rules for Life or something like that. And I thought it was going to be quite boring and just like, you know, how much more can I milk out of this self-help for young men type racket? But actually, he started off by saying something really, really interesting. He said he was talking about the importance of conversation, of communication, of talking to other people, and how it's through conversations that we filter out what is important, what is unimportant. So we're in our daily lives, we're overwhelmed by a plethora of experiences, and conversations are where I suppose, you know, you prioritize what's important and you forget about what's unimportant. So you'll have a day out, say fox hunting, and you'll remember the key bits in the conversation and you'll get rid of all the boring bits. And in the same way, this is how we make sense of our lives. We are designed to communicate, to talk to one another, and it's how we order things in our head and make sense of our existence. And what's happened in the last 12, 14 months is that we've been deprived of maybe the most important mechanism that keeps us sane, of seeing other people in large numbers and communicating with them. Now, after that subject, yes. Well, so what I wanted to know is how many like-minded folk have you felt isolated, or have you found a community of
We've got a very good community, to be fair, and we meet up a lot. Yeah, there's quite a large number of us. Yeah, in North Wales, and you know, and I have attended some of the London process, and you know, the amount of people is incredible. And this Saturday should be great. To be fair, there's one 24th.
Should one be going for a walk in London? You know, just happen to be strolling through.
Yeah, accidentally. Of course, and you know, and the police brutality there has been incredible. To be fair.
It's been shocking.
I just can't believe it. But you know, I've grown my friends group like you wouldn't believe. I mean, obviously you've lost friends.
Yes, tell me about, have you lost quite a few friends?
Yes. I've lost also, bizarrely, the Hunt that I was a subscriber to, they actually wrote me a letter to say that they didn't want to be involved with anyone that openly broke the law.
That is awful, because you would have thought the one thing about hunting folk is that they are brave, that they are contra mundum, because how can you not be contra mundum in a world where hunting is more or less illegal? There is a camaraderie. There is a kind of understanding of the value of tradition and honor, for want of a better word. I mean, you know, when you're kind of, when there's a fence you don't want to take, and that's how I got myself injured, doing something out of a kind of moral duty to show my courage in the field. You know, I'm not sure I think I've proved myself once. I don't think I need to, so I was experimenting with my lighting there, if anyone's watching and wondering about that. But so you've been kicked out. What a bunch of bedwetters.
Oh, I know. But then a couple of the other hunts have more than welcomed me, to be fair.
Are they better hunts?
So yes, much better hunts. They were just a little bit further away, so I just probably needed that push. But yeah, much better hunts, to be fair. So.
Right.
There you go. But yeah, so it is difficult when, you know, people have a different mindset. But, you know, then I've met people that maybe I wouldn't have associated with before all of this. So, you know, for someone that's a Tory that went hunting, I sort of fitted in a bit of a narrow gap in society maybe. And I wouldn't have got to associate with different types of people. And now, you know, I'm really close friends with people that I wouldn't have even met, I would have thought previously. Yeah. So that's great. And they're much more interesting than those, really, that when you look back, they were just really awful, boring people anyway, to be fair.
I know what you mean, Sharon. This has been one of the great excitements of this, amid this disaster. It's like finding yourself in a war zone and finding you're all shacked up in this, you're surrounded by machine guns and bombs and things, and there's a camaraderie. You're finding unlikely fellow kindred spirits.
But the people as well that are more trustworthy, that you realize they're people that you would actually trust if things went really wrong, whereas you realize there's other sort of flaky people who've gone out of your life were just that, they were flaking and, completely useless, really.
You definitely meet people who are more based, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And people that mean what they say and people that will have your back. So, yeah, that's great. But, yeah, I would say I've increased my friends group by quite a lot, and apart from that, you know, those few things with the police, I will say that it hasn't really, curtailed my social life or anything like that. In fact, maybe my social life's improved because, you know, it's a bit more interesting to go to parties and rather than having to pay a fortune to go to the pub. And,
I suppose there is that. I mean, you do live in crazy land. I mean, Wales under Mark Drakeford. The idea that this kind of talentless little nobody like Drakeford, you know, a Corbynista, although I rather think that Jeremy Corbyn would have made a better prime minister than Boris Johnson. You know, can you imagine?
He couldn't have been worse.
He couldn't have been worse.
At least I would have supported putting him in place. So if we had Jeremy Corbyn and he was as bad as Johnson, then, you know, maybe I wouldn't feel so guilty. Because I actually feel like I'm one of the people that helped put Johnson in his place where he is. And
we did. We voted for the rapist. I mean, not a literal rapist, because I think he's got quite a way with women and he doesn't need to do that. But I do rather feel that metaphorically in that anecdote, that imaginary scenario I painted earlier. We've definitely put a wrong on it. And I suppose we do feel bad about it. What was I saying before?
Drakeford.
It's extraordinary. He's one of those kind of grey men who worms their way into councils, doesn't he? And becomes a kind of council. He might become a council leader, but it's quite shocking that he's in charge of a whole principality and that he can impose these incredibly stringent, stricter than thou. We've seen this with the cranky woman, Sturgeon. As well in Scotland. Scotland and Wales have both competed to out fascist England in order to demonstrate they've got their special power. So, I mean, tell me about some of the craziness that's gone on in Wales with your regulation.
One of my friends, one of the reasons we went to Tesco's, he got arrested for trying to buy a toothbrush in one of the lockdowns when the non-essential things.
Wait a second. A toothbrush is non-essential?
Well, it was non-essential at one time, yeah.
And how was he arrested for that?
Because he went through the aisle and, went through the barricades, because they barricade the aisles in supermarkets for what they class to be non-essential goods, and then went in and got himself a toothbrush, and then, the staff challenged him, and it ended up with a bit of an argument, and police were called, and then somebody else ended up in court for criminal damage for pulling some polythene off some children's clothes because children's clothes were non-essential. Car parks here are just, the car parks, the Snowdonia National Park, I mean, I've been in a bit of dispute with them. They put big, massive, like the big concrete blocks that they put in inner cities, I'd say. Yeah, they put them up on the car parks to stop people parking.
What do they think would happen if you went for a walk in Snowdonia? Yes, that's right, because there was a rule where you can't exercise more than how many miles from your home?
I don't know, because I didn't comply
That's a good answer. Well done, Sharon. Very good answer.
I think it was about 5 miles or something like that. But I am lucky. I live right up on the Carnedd, which is at Snowdonia. But the main problem with that for the local people is that, I mean, good for them, but people still came. So they still came to go walking on the mountains because, like you say, why shouldn't they? I mean, and I'm completely in agreement, you know, why shouldn't they come? It's not, you know, I'm lucky to live there, but why shouldn't other people, you know, like you said about the man with his child with mental health problems, why shouldn't people that live in towns and cities come to the countryside? It's their countryside as much as ours, to be fair. And they just had nowhere to park. So what they'd do is they'd park at the side of the road. And if you imagine the little village I live in, you can't get your car past then. You know, you want to ride your horse. It's not safe to ride your horse because the cars are parked at the side of the road. And then the police will come in and book in all the cars. But it was because the car parks are shut. It's just absolute lunacy. Absolute lunacy. Yeah. And here as well on Conway Bridge, it's a one-way system now. People can only walk one way over the bridge. And you have to go round, and they've put some temporary traffic lights so people can only walk clockwise round. So they can't cross themselves on the bridge. And I asked the council if they'd done a risk assessment for the temporary traffic lights, because when it's windy, the temporary traffic lights blow down and people still think they have to comply. I just think it's a completely dangerous situation. And the council said no, they feel that because of what Mark Drakesford said, they don't have to do a risk assessment. So apparently you can't walk past somebody on a bridge in case, I don't know, you breathe over each other, but it's fine to get squashed by a lorry or something. So there you go.
Yes, isn't this one of the strangest things, the one of the most unforgivable things about these bizarre times, whereby they are prioritizing anything that protects you from this virus, alleged virus, with a 99.67% survival rate, and ignoring things like cancer, all the people who've been endangered by, I don't know, their transport policy, whereby they're shutting down, they're rerouting traffic, suicides. They don't give a toss about. This is extraordinary. They genuinely seem indifferent to all the young people topping themselves. I find that extraordinary that young people are killing themselves. This would, even 2 years ago, any death, any young person's death from suicide would have been considered a shame to the nation. It would have been, you know, heartrending stories would have been written, and rightly so. And now it's just like, well, whatever, you know, we've got to beat this imaginary virus.
I know of a friend of a friend who shoots, and one of his shooting friends who lived on the Wirral, you know, he committed suicide out of the blue because he just couldn't face the fact that they just weren't going shooting. That was his entire life and he couldn't see a way out of it. And he shot his dog, then shot himself. You know, it's just horrendous. I just know of a lot of stories like that locally.
Do you?
And it's just incredible, isn't it, that they would prioritise one illness over, you know, people's mental health as well. Because for every person that commits suicide, there must be thousands that are feeling the same but haven't actually gone through with it.
This is,
you know, I can't say that I, you know, certainly not mental health, but, you know, I've hardly been hunting this winter because we haven't been able to since Christmas. And, you know, you think, well, what's the point? You know, I find it hard to even get the motivation to ride my horses now because I think, well, why am I keeping them fit? What am I keeping them fit for? You know, are we going to hunt next season? I'm not sure that we will.
I think they're trying to kill all these things in the guise of health security, or in the guise of environmentalism, whatever. They'll find ways of stopping us doing all the things that we want to do. You look, for example, about how they're trying to now close down grouse moors. Now, grouse moors, right. The only way that you can maintain that particular kind of landscape with biodiversity and with it profitably, or at least making them pay for themselves, sort of, is if they're given over to grouse shooting, and they have to be maintained, and because the grouse only feed on young shoots, which means that you have to burn off chunks of the heather and so on. They need to be maintained, and the result, you get rich biodiversity, because you get all sorts of bird life and animal life, unlike the RSPB controlled land, where because they're so averse to any form of predator control, things like it, you get a few dominant species and everything else gets wiped out. But the deep green ideology seems to be working hand in hand with this the pandemic, and I think they're using it to destroy the countryside, to break down rural communities, to take away all our hobbies, everything that makes our lives worth living. I think this is deliberate. And which is a frightening thing to realize, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I just think they're trying to take away our rural way of life. And like you say, maybe this has been on the cards for a long time. And it's one of the reasons that I wanted to stand for the Welsh government elections, not because, I've got any great, I just wanted to give everyone an option, really, because I just think it's all being taken away from us. And I do live in a real rural community that depends on this type of thing. So, yeah.
Tell me about your, what's the party you're representing called, or is it just an independent? Are you an independent?
It's called No More Lockdowns. It's a new party, and we're all, new to everything, and we're just doing it a bit off the hoof. We've got no funding, and, I don't think we've got any chance, but, it's just, it just takes the, just...
Say not the struggle, nought availeth, Darren.
Yeah, you've got to try.
Well, absolutely.
It's called No More Lockdowns. It's a Welsh party.
Is there not an English version of it and a Scottish version of it, or is it just Welsh?
I think that's the Freedom Alliance, but this is just Welsh, yeah. And there's three candidates running for the Welsh Assembly, two in South Wales and me in North Wales in Aberconwy. It's all quite rigged against us, to be fair. Even just handing in the forms was a challenge in itself. The whole no face mask, you can't go in the council offices, so how are you meant to hand in your forms? And then there's a row about you can come in as long as you can prove you're medically exempt.
How do you do that?
I don't know how you would anyway, a lot of exemptions are not medical. And if it's a No More Lockdowns party, you'd have thought they'd have had some sort of idea that, I wasn't going to be, I was going to be exempt anyway. And now we've been told that there's going to be the counting agents, they have to be masked. So, they're not going to be my people, are they? I don't know how we're going to get to the question, on the night, the hustings are all Zoom, but, they're all biased. The council have also told the local newspapers, every time it comes up in the local newspapers, it says I'm independent when I'm not independent. We just want the party name getting out there, the No More Lockdowns party.
So how do you campaign?
And then people are like, well, we can't really. You can't give out leaflets unless you wear face masks and do... the whole hand sanitizer and gloves thing, and you can only put out leaflets, you can't canvas. So it's all completely, it's impossible, really, to be fair.
I do hope that everyone in Wales can share this video with like-minded folk, for what it's worth. I mean, you're very impressive. I'm really, because I wasn't sure... obviously you being an unknown quantity, as far as I was concerned, whether you'd have stuff to say, and you've been absolutely fantastic. And you're the kind of person I think should be in the Welsh Assembly. You know, you're much more representative of normal, real, decent
normal people.
than politicians.
Yeah, but the thing is, I'd end up getting in a row with whoever is going to replace Mark Drakeford. But you could just imagine it on the news. So, you know, here's Sharon, she's just causing a complete argument in the Senate, because I am quite, you know, I can be quite opinionated. I do, you know, and I won't give in to anything. If I feel really strongly about something, then, you know, that's it. And,
no. Well, you're
no, right. You know, God help anybody that gets in my way. If I'm really committed to something, that's it, really.
Yeah. Well, out of interest, has there been any resistance at all within the Welsh political system to this nonsense?
None that I've heard of. Not any. Like I said, the Welsh candidate and you know, our local MS, which is member of the Senate, is Janet Finch-Saunders, who was somebody that I was quite friendly with. But no, you know, there's just been nothing. And you would think, being a Tory, standing in a you know, the Labour-led Senate, that she would give some opposition. But yeah. No, it's just the same as the Westminster lot. You know, so, I mean, now I just think that Labour and the Tories are the same thing.
Which they
and
are.
And it's interesting now. Because also in Wales we've got Plaid Cymru, and the Plaid Cymru candidate is probably the favourite as well. Is him and Janet a head to head? But it's interesting when you hear them all talking now. If they don't really talk about what's happening, you'd think that they would. You know, they think that they're making out it's all been a bit of a blip, and we're all going to get back to normal.
Yeah, right.
You know, and all their campaign literature is just about, you know, build back better, and oh, we're going to get the tourists back, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And you think, well, what are you going to do in September, when I'm pretty sure they're going to try and put us on lockdown?
There's going to be another lockdown in October, I think. Would be my
where I agree. Put my money. And yeah, then, so you know, we're not going to not do this again. But that's what all of the, you know, the mainstream parties are all trying to make out, that this is. This has just been a blip, and we're just back to normal now. And,
it's extraordinary, isn't it?
You know.
But don't you find really, that once you realise what's going on, everything you realise is just a pantomime and a circus to distract you from, for example, there's a story at the moment about football. I don't know the details, but it's on the front page. I mean, I haven't even read it. But something is happening in football which people are getting worked up about. And I'm thinking, hang on a second. Your country has been turned into a fascist state. You can't go to the pub without pointing your phone, or pretending to point your phone at a whatever those things are called.
QR code.
Yeah. You can't get into a pub without booking. You can't move. I went into a pub yesterday, and there was more than six of us, so we couldn't communicate with the two tables. Between the two tables, we were segregated, even though we were one party, and all this nonsense. And you think this should be the only topic of conversation, and the only topic of conversation should be, how do we end this shit right now? Or preferably, how do we end this shit 12 months ago? And instead people are going, oh, something has happened with kickyball, some sort of thing that is really, really, you know, and Prince William's got involved. You think, no, this is wrong.
We don't care. With it, you know, all not going on holiday. I mean, who is Boris Johnson to tell us that we can't go abroad? I went to South Africa at Christmas, by the way.
Oh, well done.
So when they put us in the next lockdown and they said, well, I realised there was going to be no more hunting, I booked some flights and thought I'd go and find the South African strain. But anyway, I didn't.
Well, how was South Africa doing? Because I mean, they're run by lunatics, aren't they? Was it masks?
It was great. I had no problem with no masks, no problem at all. It was like here. you know, you could go into the supermarket and say, I'm exempt. They looked quite shocked, though, when you said you're exempt. So I don't think they were used to people who would say no, but there was no trouble. And they were absolutely fine, actually. And you said, no, I'm exempt. Oh, really sorry. So that was no trouble. Coming back was a bit of a excitement because they cancelled all the flights. So my friend couldn't get her her direct flight back. So she got a bit stuck in South Africa. But I came back via Doha. And it was quite scary because we flew into Doha. It was me on my own. And when the plane landed, we had to go down the steps. And as you went down the steps, there were armed guards in Doha. And they were putting all the people that weren't going on ongoing flights into a bus to go to a quarantine center. And it was quite chilling, really, because that did remind me of, you know, I just thought, gosh, this is like Nazi Germany, you know, where are they taking these people? Because there were people crying.
Is Doha in the United Arab? Qatar. Sorry?
It's Qatar.
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 Right. Yeah. And then did you have to go through any nonsense when you got back to the UK?
Yeah, so then I had to go Qatar. So I saw what had happened and I thought, gosh, and that was quite shocking. So, but, you know, actually the no mask thing and everything was fine. And I, you know, I didn't have any trouble. But you did have to be quite firm, you know, no, I'm exempt, but, you know, it's no problem. And I got back on the plane from Doha to Manchester. And on the plane, they made you fill in a form to give in. At the other side, you had to fill it in online. And it said that, you know, have you been to South Africa? And I thought, well, actually, I've seen what happened to those people in Doha. So I thought, well, I'll just say, no, I've not been there. So I did lie on my form. And those are the forms that in January, Matt Hancock said you could go to prison, didn't he, for filling in incorrectly. But anyway, that was before he'd said that. So I did lie because I thought, well, why would I tell the truth anyway?
You know, why would you tell the truth to the Gestapo? Unless they pulled out all your fingernails and even then you wouldn't do it.
Exactly. I was flying into my own country, you know, so I just filled in the form with a load of nonsense. Landed in Manchester and there they were, armed police. Have you been to South Africa? And they were putting us into two queues. So one for the people that have been to South Africa and one queue for the people that haven't. So I thought, well, I know what I'm going to answer here. I want to be in the queue for the people that haven't been to South Africa. So I did lie and say, no, I have never been to South Africa in my whole life. No,
I've never even heard of the place.
Never heard of it. Well, but we got in the no queue. And then they just kept asking you, and they asking you for this QR code from this online form that you'd put in on the plane. But obviously my QR code said that I'd never been to South Africa ever in my life, so that was okay. So I carried on in the queue. But unfortunately, my passport wouldn't do an automatic scan to get out. So then they said, you've got to go to the actual border control. So I got to the desk and the man said, have you been to South Africa? And I said, nope, never been there in my whole life. And they opened my passport and obviously there was the stamp with South Africa. So I was put in a room with an armed guard with me shouting and banging on the door about my human rights and how it said in my passport that I was allowed to travel unhindered in and out of my own country. And they just looked really, really confused. So anyway, eventually, I think I just drove them nuts because they said that, you know, I could go.
You were a bloody difficult woman.
That someone would come to my house and check that I was self-isolating. But luckily, I live in the countryside. No one can ever find my house anyway. So.
That's good. Listen, you've got to keep riding, even if there's no hunting at the end of it. I mean, do you normally ride every day?
A couple of times a week. I've got two hunters. I've got four horses. But I've got two hunters that I
what
keep
are
in
the Irish? Are they sports horses?
One's an Irish. One's a real Irish, rough and ready looking cob. He just loves hunting, and you know the biggest hedges are his thing. And he's 22, but he's still up for it. And then I've got a 17-3 warm blood who's very posh looking and really looks the part, but unfortunately he's not overly keen on too much mud and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I tend to ride him more in the summer, and the rough and ready Irish one in more.
I don't know about warm bloods. I'm not very good on. I mean, I love horses, but I'm not an expert. What's a warm blood?
They're quite posh. You know, have you heard of Hanoverians and? Selfronte, half had Selfronte and half Hanoverian. They're quite good at dressage. And,
oh, I see.
You know, they're very popular now. Warm bloods for hunting, show jumping, and dressage are those very fancy looking horses. But yeah, I think for hunting, the rough and ready Irish ones always the one.
I think the Irish ones, the ones that look after you. I normally ride on borrowed horses, but. I normally ride an Irish draft, but today I got given a thoroughbred, and it's really weird riding a thoroughbred because they're completely different from riding Irish drafts. You know, like when you pull on the reins to stop them, slow them down, they go faster. I mean, there are all sorts of weird things with thoroughbreds that you know you don't want to use too much leg. You just want to give them the slightest hint of a signal. Just release the reins, push the reins forward slightly, and they'll just take off. It's amazing.
Well, that's what I was riding in South Africa. We went riding horses in South Africa. So we went to watch the hunt go off in Johannesburg on Boxing Day.
Oh, gosh.
So they still
what do they hunt,
out.
Jackals yeah. or?
No, they're actually, they have to be a drag hunt because, they just have to. And the country's quite tight. But they do use a jackal scent.
I imagine it's quite hard if you fall off in South Africa. Do they have grass in that?
Yeah,
part of the
ground was quite hard, and they only hunt. So that's their summer, but they can't hunt in their winter because the ground's hard in winter because it's drier.
Yes.
So it was really interesting. But there's a girl there that does hirelings, and they're thoroughbreds. So we went and rode them. And they're polo horses, and they were lovely, but they were thoroughbreds, and yeah, a lot different to what we
they
used
are.
To
they are. It's like being given the keys to a Ferrari, and thinking, oh my gosh, what have I let myself in for?
A warm blood's not like that. You'll have to come to Wales and come riding.
I will have to come to Wales. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I've only ridden once in Wales, and it was lovely. I mean, it's a completely different country from riding where I live.
We could gallop on the beach here.
That's good. I like that. Doesn't it? I think I've wondered about galloping on the beach. You're riding across compacted sand, which presumably you don't want to fall off on that.
No, you really don't want to fall off that on that. It hurts a lot.
No.
Luckily I don't fall off that often. I have ridden since before I could walk, so
I
tend to be able to hang on for dear life.
Well done.
I wouldn't say I'm very stylish, but I can hang on for dear life.
I think some people have said that about me, that I'm not very stylish, but I do have a good seat generally. Anyway, Sharon, it's been lovely to talk to you, and I wish your What is it called?
No more lockdowns.
No more lockdowns. I hope that lots of people in Wales vote for you. And if they discover that you're standing and that the party exists.
Yeah, they just need to find out that I'm standing because nobody knows. And it's just so difficult to get the word out there now. And, you know, everybody that I know is either banned from Facebook or Twitter or about to be banned. And, you know, it's
the purge
just
continues.
Incredible. I know. Oh, well,
so,
thanks, James.
Thank you, Sharon. It only reminds me to say, and I'm really bad at this, so please, everyone, remember, I do really appreciate your support on Patreon, on Subscribestar. If you want to buy a special friend badge, which you can do, go to my website, dellingpoleworld.com, and you'll find the details there. I really appreciate your support. You know how difficult it is in these times where we're being closed down right, left and centre. And yeah, you need voices like mine, I think. And please support Sharon's No Lockdown, No More Lockdowns candidacy in the Welsh elections. Thank you. Thanks a lot. It's been really great talking to you.
Thanks, James. Take care.